This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. Over the past few weeks, we've interviewed poets and musicians who've offered their creative responses to a war with Iraq. Today, we've selected a segment from The Fire This Time, portraying a time when sanctions and war violations had taken a visible toll on Iraqi civilians. This report is called No News is Good News.
The country they liberated, Kuwait, and the aggressor country, Iraq, are both tonight in a worsening state of chaos.
This is the first sight of the uprising that's raging inside Iraq. The lightly armed rebels can demonstrate defiance of Saddam Hussein, but their leaders accept they have little chance of toppling him unless they can get outside help.
I think the whole of sanctions should stay while Saddam Hussein is in power, because the Iraqi people have to have an incentive to stand up to him and get him out.
The opposition within the country, of course, listened to the West and rose against Saddam Hussein, only to be confronted by the United States in particular, helping Saddam Hussein against them. They actually stopped rebels from reaching arms depots. They flew over his helicopters as his helicopters attacked them. They gave his Republican Guard safe passage through their lines to attack the rebels. They did everything except join the fight on his side.
But if you're going to sustain cheap and plentiful supplies of oil, you've got to have a regime there to ensure that you can provide it.
A special United Nations envoy is warning that Iraq is facing a catastrophe unless food and fuel are allowed into the country.
You asked me to travel, as a matter of urgency, to Iraq. It should be said at once that nothing we had seen or read had prepared us for the devastation which has befallen the country. Most means of modern life have been destroyed. The authorities are as yet scarcely able to measure the dimensions of the calamity, much less respond to its consequences. The conflict has wrought near-apocalyptic results. Iraq has been relegated to a pre-industrial age.
You people didn't leave anything that you did not target your planes on it.
Everything was bombed. Schools, churches, mosques, roads, factories, farms, homes, everything.
And throughout day and night, the bombing continued.
Cats were frightened, and their noises with the planes, it was something very disturbing. It brought everything ugly to your imagination. And I think this is the real war.
To prevent future wars and to maintain American influence, many more arms must be sold to these countries in the years ahead.
When you're dealing with friends and allies, if you provide the equipment, you have a string on it, which means that you probably can contaminate their thinking with your values.
You people watched us. You people watched our country being demolished. You watched us in your living room through the gun sight cameras.
Without asking any question, where do these bombs fall?
Article 48 of the Geneva Convention states,
it is prohibited to attack, destroy, remove, or render useless objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population. And this is precisely what was the target of many of our smart bombs. We must ask ourselves, did the war have to be fought in this way?
The same question was put to a Pentagon planner.
What were we trying to do with the sanctions? Help out the Iraqi people? No. What we were doing with the attacks on the infrastructure was to accelerate the effect of sanctions.
In April, new Security Council resolutions were tabled. A UN Special Commission, UNSCOM, was given unprecedented power to seek and destroy Iraq's weapons capability. Sanctions levied to force a withdrawal from Kuwait would now be used to ensure Iraq's compliance with UNSCOM.
Sanctions are now in these new circumstances, a vital lever in making sure that Iraq complies with her international obligations.
The time has come to try to change the destructive pattern of military competition and proliferation in this region and to reduce arms flow.
But even as James Baker was speaking, elsewhere in the administration, very different plans were being laid. The post-war arms deal to the Gulf states, worth between $50 and $150 billion.
We will also still be controlling the economic sanctions, and in particular, preventing the export of oil. In other words, Iraq cannot recover from this war with that situation.
I saw a baby with a big tummy and legs like sticks. His mouth was bleeding. His hair was falling. We're just shocked because we didn't saw such a thing before. We asked, what's this case? They said, this is a kwashiorkor.
Children who get to this stage of nutritional deprivation are found throughout all of Iraq and rarely survive.
Kwashiorkor had not been seen in Iraq for 3 decades. The Security Council removed foodstuffs from the list of embargoed items and established a sanctions committee to screen goods coming into Iraq. Food and medicine were now officially exempt, but...
How do you buy the food? How do you pay for it? If they freeze your assets and they don't permit you to export, where do you get the money to buy it? That's a fallacy. The West is playing on words.
Nasir Shama and Stephen Wilson performed improvised music in that piece from The Fire This Time, produced by Hidden Art, the Gulf War protest CD set. While the movement against the war in Iraq appears to be growing to some, there remains a risk of another anti-war movement becoming ineffective and stagnant. Michael Albert, the editor of Z Magazine, offered his critique of the left at Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts. He spoke during a conference organized by the American Friends Service Committee.
The war on terrorism is not a war, and it's not about terrorism. It's not a war because the United States doesn't fight wars anymore. The last war we fought was in Indochina. That was arguably a war. The casualties on our side, by and large, are due to accidents. It's safer to be in an American war on the American side than it is to be a cop in Detroit. So it's not really a war. What it is a call it a campaign. It's an attempt to reorient life in the United States and in the world in such a way that elites, that political and corporate elites, can do what they want to do. It's an attempt to use patriotism, but mostly to use fear and anger to justify and to rationalize behavior which would otherwise be impossible. If we have that demonstration of 400,000 people in London every week from now until when the war in Iraq is over, it will not change the war in Iraq. So what will do it? If it's necessary that our activism challenge what they hold dear, what does the character of our movement need to be? A movement that becomes more militant is more costly because it says people are moving in their commitment. Their commitment is getting deeper and stronger. So if the demonstration first has 10,000 and 20 and 50, and then it starts to have civil disobedience along with it, it seems to me that what really is a cost is the connections that get made. If we are just against one thing, a war in Iraq, it is very different than if the movement is beginning to display an orientation that goes beyond that, to foreign policy in general, to globalization, to corporations, to capitalism. That's threatening. That's a trajectory of development of a movement. So how do we get diversity of consciousness into our movements? It won't happen automatically. We have to talk about it. So we can't have a movement whose characteristics are such that it is more onerous to be in the movement than it is to be at work. Right? The movement has to be a place that, I mean that sincerely, because often we construct projects that have that flavor. They are more picky. They are more demanding in ways that make no sense. One thing we have to do is not denigrate the people who we are trying to reach. My experience going out and talking on campuses is very often something like this. I'm in College Park, Pennsylvania. There's about 400 people in the room, leftists on the campus. They were totally, completely different than everybody else on the campus in their looks and in their way of dressing. How can that uniformity be true? But as striking as that was, what was really striking was I said, how many of you have been to a football game? College Park is one of the central, you know, college football towns in the entire United States. It's Joe Paterno's school, you know, Pennsylvania. Actually, there were two or three black activists in the room who had been to a football game, but everybody else hadn't. There is no group on that campus, no group, the knitting club, the railroad club, the student, there is no other group on that campus that you could put in a room and get anything more than maybe, you know, 10% who hadn't been to a football game, and the left, nobody had been. I asked how many of you have been into the bar around the corner that I passed on the way here. It's this humongous bar. It's huge. And it's full of students, and they're all big. This is a football school. I mean, seriously. I went by the place, and they're all, I mean, these are jocks, right? They are big, strong, athletic men and women in this bar. I said, how many of you have been in there? Now they're laughing on the floor. They're hysterical. Only a lunatic would go in that bar and try and organize, or somebody who wants to win. What I told them is, if you don't want to go in that bar and organize, if you don't get up each day wanting to do that more than anything else on this campus, except perhaps go into the stadium and organize, don't bother. Don't bother. You're not serious. They didn't like that. An hour and a half later, we were on friendly terms again. But I think that what we have to do in order to win, obviously, is to reach constituencies that we don't reach. Now, the point of that is that I think that our movements are very often somewhat, shall we say, not congenial, not welcoming, and not empowering to working people. I think there are a lot of reasons for that. 30 years ago, the women's movement and the civil rights movement, the anti-racist, in particular, black movement at the time, said to the left, you know, if you run your organizations and you embody in your organizations the culture and the structures of Playboy and a white golf club, if it's basically Jim Crow inside your movement and patriarchy inside your movement, our groups are not going to be in your movement. And anybody who goes in will be so frustrated and upset that they will leave. So what has to happen is that the movement has to address its own internal dynamics and try and embody in itself what it believes is true and valid and desirable for a good society regarding race and gender. It has to do it because it's right, and it has to do it because strategically it is a disaster to not do it. That message was correct. It was heard, not without some struggle, and attempts to a degree successful, to a considerable degree successful, I think, have been made to deal with it. It hasn't been solved, but a lot has gone into it. No such message has ever been delivered, and no such attempt, in my view, has ever been made with respect to class. So many left organizations have structures that mirror Time Magazine or Newsweek, that have decision-making methods that are basically a corporate division of labor. This is alienating to working people. The fact that most of us watch only The Simpsons, the fact that everybody watches The Simpsons on the left and nobody watches football is a serious problem when you're going to try and communicate with working class America. A serious problem. It's not that it's immoral to watch The Simpsons, and it's not that it's profoundly moral to watch football, but it is profoundly weird to have a movement that's trying to organize in a country that can't speak the language that the country speaks. Go organize in France not speaking French. Organize in the United States with an attitude which says religion sucks, football sucks, movies suck, TV sucks, you know, McDonald's sucks. Everything that you want to do sucks, right? And we're here to tell you why. So our ability to try and understand where people are coming from and respect their positions and their efforts to live a good life and a reasonable life in grotesque circumstances is absolutely essential if we're going to build an anti-war movement that can win. If all we want to do is build an anti-war movement to have an anti-war movement, no problem. But if we want to build one to win, then we have to diversify. We have to have a movement which has multiple tactics, some of which are more militant. We have to have a movement which has multiple issues, which connect the issues up. And we have to have a movement which is congenial to the constituencies we need to reach.
Michael Albert, editor of Z Magazine, speaking to a conference organized by the American Friends Service Committee in Boston. The Bush administration's campaign for war is taking place against the backdrop of the elections next week, and the scenario is inspiring poets to write themselves into the debate. Rian Kathuda from Pacifica's WPFW in Washington has more.
Alan Barish is a poet and an activist from Baltimore. When he published Resist to Exist, Mark Calasurdo of Baltimore Writers Alliance described his work as radical political work, liberation poetry, revolutionary verse, laced with humor, jazzy meters, and a full cup of the milk of human kindness. Here, he wrote for the plowshares activists and for all the anti-war activists.
It's easy to be a vegetarian when you've just had a meal and dined on chicken, fish, or shrimp, or maybe beef or veal. And it's a cinch to be for peace when the cannons cease to roar and the soldiers are not marching out to fight another war. But when the call to battle's given and the nation's flags are flying, that's when it really takes some guts to stand against the dying. 'Cause when the battle's over and the shooting starts to cease, everybody and their Uncle Sam will say they were for peace. When the call to war is given in each and every land, midst the volleys of the rifles is where you should take a stand. Though some will call you coward and say what you do is treason, remember, convictions are not summer coats to be shed in winter season. Don't be another good German and go along just for the ride, and have others point out how you had a hand in making genocide. Yes, it's easy to be anti-war when no one is enlisting. When the call to arms is given out, that's when to start resisting.
There's a wide polarization between political poets and what I call either gibberish poets or cheesy erotica poets. There seems to be an uneasy truce between them. And I notice at some of the open readings, the poetry is not as exciting as it has been. However, in the venues where I work with a group of people called Gimme Shelter Productions, where we actually do benefits for homeless shelters, and most of us are more political poets, a more positive response, because people are coming to actually hear something political.
And when you say nowadays, what do you mean?
When I first started reading poetry, the poetry seemed to have more of a purpose. Nowadays, the poetry I hear, political poets have to actually step up our work and step out even further now. At least that's the way it is in the Baltimore scene.
And how about this war on Iraq, though? Where does it put you?
It's a challenge to those people who really say what they believe in to actually step up. As with anybody who's concerned about justice and peace and human rights issues, the challenge is on us to actually step up and be a little less afraid of the negative response. But remember, there are millions out there that are looking for something, looking for a break, looking for an opening to join with us. If we can create this breakthrough, if we can create this breathing space, then others will join us.
You think poetry is efficient for that?
Poetry in of itself is part of breaking through this deadening barrier that we have, but it's not the be-all and end-all. That poets who are activists have to be activists and poets and activists. If you're going to write a poem about struggle, you have to be in the midst of the struggle, otherwise it becomes dull and academic. On my CD, there's a poem called You Ain't Crazy, You Just Live in America. This poem was inspired by a telephone answering machine message by Kenneth Carroll, who's a D.C. poet, and it's called You Ain't Crazy, You Just Live in America. When you look around and think everyone here has yellow ribbon fever, and every former Fred Hampton is now an Eldridge Cleaver, and the news of the day makes you feel like an angry cynic as you see armed so-called pro-life people kill a doctor at his abortion clinic. And at the end of the day, when you want to relax and just unwind, do you worry hard round midnight about the state of your own mind? 'Cause you hear so many people with their minds all full of mush, talking on in loving tones about their talk show hero, Rush. Does it really make you wonder? Does it cause you lots of pain? Do you wonder, is it all of them, or am I going insane? When you hear that some gay people want to play G.I. Jean or G.I. Joe, do you start to doubt your efforts to get folks to say hell no? When you wonder, as you lie awake in bed so late at night, whether Clinton's actions in his college days were the only thing he did right? Do you wonder about the state of people's consciousness in the USA? Do you think that you're the mad one in this batty world today? Oh, don't let yourself go crazy worrying about all of this jive. Remember, for every 1917, there is a 1905. Though the road it looks quite rocky, full of setbacks, twists, and turns, there's a fire for liberation, and in most people it still burns. No, there's nothing wrong with your mind. You're quite normal in every way. No, you aren't going nutty. You're living in the USA. So go on with what you're doing. There's nothing wrong with you. Sometime soon you will meet others who also feel like you. One more word or two I must remind you before this little poem is through. Watch the names that you call yourself, 'cause this fact of life is true. You may call yourself Bobby, Jake, Danny, Beth, or Erica, but don't call yourself crazy. You're just living in America.
Okay, Alan, and in closing, what are some of your thoughts regarding this build-up against a war against Iraq?
If anybody thinks that it's too soon to protest that, think about this. Is it going to be any easier to protest this war if it gets launched and gets going? I don't think so. It's going to be harder. We have to support stations like WPFW, which tell the truth. We need to tell people that during the beginning and during all points of the war, that the anti-war movement always welcomed soldiers into their midst who wanted to do more than just fight the war. At the same time, we told them that what they were doing was wrong, that any soldier was welcome to march with us in the anti-war effort.
Thank you very much, Alan Barish. Poet, activist, a kind human being from Baltimore, Maryland, also a member of WPFW's local advisory board. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I am Reem Katkhuda.
And for our spiritual segment on Pacifica's Peace Watch, our response this evening from Manjit Singh, who is the chair of SMART Media Watch and Resource Task Force in Germantown, Maryland.
Primarily, we are concerned about seeing more explicit proof that Iraq is a threat to the United States.
Is the Sikh religion one that believes that there are occasions where war is just, or does it pull from a pacifist belief that war is not appropriate at any point in time?
No, actually the Sikh faith does believe that war in certain situations is appropriate and just.
And so is that the case, in your opinion, with this war against Iraq? President Bush has articulated a case that Saddam Hussein poses a threat not only to the U.S., but to the region, to the Middle East region, and that it's necessary to launch a preemptive strike.
Actually, we are not convinced. We haven't seen any concrete evidence of that fact. We don't know what changed since 9/11. That Iraq suddenly became a threat and was not a threat in the first 9 months of this administration. We are also very concerned about the approach of this administration to launch a preemptive strike, which would essentially break not only from the American foreign policy, but also from the international accepted foreign policy. And that is concerning, especially because there are several countries around the world which will then take that as a cue to launch preemptive strikes against their neighbors or their perceived threats from other outside nations. And in fact, I would suggest it could also be applied very well internally by certain nations against its own people by saying they are a threat to national security.
The followers of the Sikh faith and religion, are there particular practices that they should be engaging in, spiritual practices, to try and further peace around this issue, in your opinion?
The specific practices which a Sikh is required to be involved all the time is to uphold justice. That is an integral part of being a Sikh, wherever they might see it necessary. So, you know, in your neighborhoods, at home, at school, in your workplace, we really believe that one needs to raise the voice, both as a citizen of this country and also as people of faith.
How large is the Sikh population in the U.S., would you say?
It's about 500,000. The regions in California, both in Northern California and in Southern California, in L.A. and Orange County, in the Bay Area, San Francisco, San Jose, and also up in Northern California, so Sacramento, Yuba City, and Fresno. On the East Coast, it's primarily New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And then there are other smaller pockets in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Houston.
Do you think Sikhs have a responsibility in keeping with the tenet of the faith to uphold justice to, say, for example, does that translate into any sort of political action, attending peace rallies or contacting congressmen or women with regard to their perspective on this, writing the president? How should it manifest itself?
In fact, it would manifest in all of those possible ways that you just talked about. And people have been doing that. You know, when we interact with members of our community, we hear them, being concerned about this war. And so people are writing in, they're talking to the congressmen, especially with the elections being around the corner. Many who are attending either political rallies or meeting with, candidates in the November 5th election are voicing their concern about the intention of the administration to wage war against Iraq.
How would you characterize or describe the Sikh faith to someone who may not be fully aware?
Faith is one of the youngest organized religions in the world. It's the fifth largest, with about 24 million Sikhs around the globe. The core beliefs is in upholding justice, in the belief in one God, who is the supreme being and considers all living beings and all humans to be the same. The belief in earning our living by honest means, sharing whatever we have with others, and finally, by living a life in remembrance of God at all times.
Manjit Singh, chair of SMART, the Sikh Media Watch and Resource Task Force in Germantown, Maryland. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's produced by Scott Gurian, engineered by Granger Helvey, consultant Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini, editor Reem Kathuda. We had help from David Russo of the Indie Media Center of Washington, D.C., and production assistance from Sidrak Franklin of WPFW. We had web help from Pete Caracas and RadioForAll.net. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or you can visit the website at www.pacificaarchives.org. Please email us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.